Hello, this is Jenny Devitt, back with another edition of Countryside Matters, and welcome. Today we'll be hearing from several of those people who represented different organisations at the World Heritage Day and Jurassic Park at 25 event held at the Dorset Museum in Dorchester earlier in April. We'll also hear from Dr. Emma Phipps of charity Songbird Survival about what certain pet flea treatments are doing to our garden birds, and then from vet Kirk Hutton more specifically about how the chemicals in those treatments work and what vets are doing to try and minimise the damage to wildlife and aquatic invertebrates. We're going to start, though, with some gardening advice. You know, I always learn something when I go to see Mike Burks of the Gardens Group, and my latest visit to him at Castle Gardens the other day was no exception. On that visit, I learned some very useful facts about fruit trees. As springtime is now very well advanced, I said to Mike I thought we probably missed the boat in terms of it being the right time to plant fruit trees.
No, not really, because they're all now in containers, and container growing has sort of come on so much that actually it makes these trees available the whole year round. If you were to ask me what's the ideal time for planting them, I would say in the autumn, and that means that when the soil's warm and moist and the roots of the tree can get out and get the tree established over the winter. So that's the ideal time, but to be honest, as long as you can keep them well watered, they can be planted at any time, and there's still a lovely selection here in Malcolm's fruit tree, so yes.
Now, I'm thinking in terms of, I mean, I've got a fairly big garden, so the size of the tree doesn't really matter too much. But supposing I just had, well, standing by the fruit trees, let's just take a section of these penned areas and say I only had a garden 3 metres by 3 metres. What could I plant? I mean, it'd have to be in a pot, presumably.
Yes, could be in a pot quite happily. In the but what you need to go for is a dwarf tree. And so with fruit trees, especially apples, there has been developed over a number of years what's known as dwarfing rootstocks. And so the variety, so in this case the tree we're looking at is a variety called James Grieve, which is a lovely apple, very, very useful in the southwest because it copes with the wet conditions that we've got, and it is a nice robust variety. But the variety, sort of a cox-like looking apple, a bud from it is grafted onto the rootstock, which is a dwarfing rootstock, and what that does, it controls the size of the tree but also increases the amount of flower and therefore fruit that you get from the tree. So you've got more flowers and fruit per branch, if you like, than you would do if it was allowed to grow on its own roots. And it also means that it fruits earlier in its life than it would do if it was on its own roots.
Well, why is that?
It's all to do with slowing down the growth. So lots of plants, the way they think, if you like, is that if life is great for them and conditions are wonderful, they'll grow like mad. So they put on lots of leaf and lots of branches, lots of root. It's only when life starts to get trickier or tougher, then they'll start to flower. So they put, I'm generalizing, and it's not true of all plants. So if you can control their growth, then you increase the amount of flower, because the plant's job, the tree's job, is to keep the species going. So it'll set fruit and therefore then seed inside the fruit just to keep the species going. So by controlling the growth, you get earlier flowers on a much smaller tree and more flowers and more fruit.
So that tree then is still trying to produce the same amount of flowers and fruit that it would if it were allowed to grow to its natural height of, say, I don't know, 15 feet, something like that.
In effect, yes, yeah. So when I was, part of my training was down working on a fruit farm in Kent, and I remember the manager there saying that, he said, we're in the fruit business, Mike, not the timber business. So what he was meaning was smaller trees, compact trees, and in that case where it's being done commercially, easy to pick as well, so you didn't have to have ladders to go up into the trees to pick the fruit, so you could reach it, and so it's the modern way of doing it. So the good advantage for us is that actually where garden size has got a whole lot smaller, so there are apple trees that will fit into just about any garden, and also because they're smaller, they will grow happily in a pot which is what you were suggesting earlier on. But I would plant them in a pot with a soil-based compost, so John Innes number 3 is perfect. And then you've got to keep them well watered and keep them well fed, and they'll do very, very nicely for you.
And presumably what you could do to help stop water evaporation from the surface is put bark chippings?
Yes, bark chippings. So you can see that these in the garden centre have got on the top, and that keeps the weeds down but also keeps the moisture in, stops the evaporation. But you'll find they come in all sorts of different shapes as well. So here we have some which are...
Oh, very much shorter. Yeah, I mean, it's only
very,
about
very
the one that right next to you. There's only about 2.5 feet tall.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or also 70 centimetres in new money.
Yes, indeed. And tall and slim as well. So I'll show you this one.
No lateral branches. I mean, just one main stem?
So this was some breeding that was done actually probably 30 years ago. But it's producing a very slim plant. This particular variety, which has got the
this is an apple, the
pink variety, it's an apple. Mm. Yeah, so it's a variety called Princess Heather, and will produce a red fruit, but it's got a purpley foliage and dark pink flowers, which are just out now. And so actually makes it's a lovely plant for the for a small garden, because it's compact, but it's quite attractive visually, so ornamental as well as edible. And of course, where you've got a small garden, that's really important that you've got things that do have many different features as you possibly can.
And this variety won't produce branches then?
No,
it's just the main stem, and that's it.
Tiny amount of branching, yeah. And it's
though this one has got a little sort of few clusters of leaves down there and some I can see where it's actually flowered.
Yes, yeah, so just
and
the
probably
just
setting
the
fruit.
Fruiting
That's
growth,
not going it? To give you a huge crop, of course, is it?
Not a huge crop, but surprising how much that you will get. So you'll have to believe me, or even look at the pictures there to see that actually you do get a nice cluster all across the stem. So you can see that every flower could be an apple come the end of the year. So.
Yeah, but of course, if you were a great apple eater, this one wouldn't keep you going for very long, would it?
Well, have a second tree then. That's the way to do it.
Have a little orchard, a mini orchard, yeah, in your small garden.
And then just over here is really, I love these. So,
oh, I'm going to stop you. Apple and pear step over trees.
Yeah, so these are really interesting. So this is again on a dwarfing rootstock, but these have been trained so that the branches have been bent, and so I guess that's standing about 18 inches off the ground.
So it's effectively an espalier.
Yeah, an espalier, but with a single tier. So the idea with these is that you'd use them in a garden, perhaps to separate the vegetable garden from the ornamental garden, as like a living fence, if you like, a low living fence.
But you could do that in an allotment too, couldn't you?
Most certainly, yeah. And it's a really, really nice thing to do. So creating a barrier, but also a barrier that's useful to you with its flowers and fruit. And there you'll see there's a pear variety looking really very fine, being done in the same way.
Which has flowered and...
Yeah. And will have...
Has got
fruit. So that's the apple that's got the... But
the
yeah, most certainly. But
it.
Even on a young tree... It's a really nice.
What of it? Is this something quite new then, Mike?
No, it's been done for years, but it's sort of relatively new for us to have them available in the garden centre. But it's a lovely thing.
It's very attractive, isn't it? I mean, you could almost, you've got four pots there for sale side by side, but presumably one could have. There's no reason why you couldn't have several in your little garden.
Absolutely.
Just exactly
as you
have
different
here.
Varieties. And then what you do is you can see how this is putting new growth on now, which is about 6 or 8 inches of new growth already. But what you do there is that you'd add some more canes to horizontally, and then you'd...
So you're forcing it to be horizontal rather than its natural tendency to grow upwards.
Yeah, so gently bending it down. The principle is that a branch that's going upwards will grow but not flower. A branch that's going horizontally or downwards will flower and fruit. And so quite a lot of modern fruit growing, the pruning is done in the summer to slow down the growth and to increase the flowering, and also the growth is put horizontally or downwards, and that will increase its ability to flower. So it's another sort of slowing down thing and produces
How
more.
How very fruit. Interesting. Yeah. You mentioned pruning. These trees would not be a challenge to prune, would they?
No.
Because they're waist high, virtually.
And again, this is then the other principle, which is if you prune in the winter, you promote growth, and if you prune in the summer, you promote fruit. And people then say, well, how do I know what to prune in the summer? Well, you can see on this one that the flowers have come on the growth that was made last year, and so what we've got is this year's growth, and then what I would do with this in the summer, so June perhaps the earliest, but July and even August, is thinning out some of the fresh growth.
So would you nip out the end?
Yeah, probably. By that stage it'll be out to about a foot or 18 inches. And I would take the end, I would prune it to a downward facing bud so that the growth then is like that and then comes downwards from there. And that will promote more fruit. So what I'm doing is then taking out the vigour of the tree and promoting flowers for next year. So winter pruning promotes growth, summer pruning promotes fruit.
So is it a little bit more challenging? I mean, it sounds a little bit more challenging than pruning a normal full-size apple or pear tree.
No, not at all, because it's just secateurs, you're not using a saw, and it all becomes clear when you get to that stage. So it's difficult to imagine it now, but once you get to that stage, these flowers will be fruit, so you're not pruning those off. It's all the fresh growth, which you can see is a different colour, and it's very flexible. So you can see I'm bending that sort of 180 degrees through, so you can, so easy to do, and it becomes clear. And I often think that pruning apples in the winter is really good fun, but actually you've no clue whether you're doing it properly or not, really. But in the summer,
especially if you're tottering on top of a ladder up a full-size tree,
right.
You mean?
Yeah. So sometimes pruning in the winter, people think they're reducing the size of a tree, but all they're doing is causing the tree to put on massive growth. So because actually the tree will try and balance what it's got below the ground with what it's got above the ground. So if you take lots off above the ground, then the tree will say, I've got not enough above ground, so it creates massive growth.
So you're saying you need to do a lighter prune
if you don't want over exuberant
growth.
So if you want
I can see
more
where I've
fruit,
been going wrong.
less growth, yes, summer pruning, not winter pruning, and that will keep the tree balanced nicely, and you'll have more fruit as a result, yeah.
So summer pruning keeps the tree slightly under control, stops the exuberant growth.
Yeah.
Produces balance. Thank you very much for that tip. Now behind you, sort of coming out of your left ear, your right ear, is what looks very like a cherry tree. Now,
yes,
I always wonder whether you can actually prune cherries.
So this is a Morello cherry. So this is growing on as a half standard. So that's got a clear stem of about 4 feet. So this will grow as a proper tree. So Morellos are a cooking cherry. They're really rather nice. Nice flowers, which are now finished, but you can see the even
tree. Or you pop them in your G&T.
Yes, absolutely. That's a good way of doing it, yes. And this has got a nice bit of fruit on it already. So with cherries, again, don't ever prune them in the winter because you'll just cause chaotic growth the next year. So only ever in the summer, and do them after the fruit has set, and that's when the tree will suddenly put on lots of growth. And again, it's the thinning out the
and you want
thinning
you
out
want
the
that growth.
Growth
to go to the fruit,
yes.
Don't you?
Yes, you do. Yes. So it's thinning out some of the fresh growth. And the others that are like that as well is plums.
Ah, so, I wanted to ask about plums, whether you can actually prune them.
Yes, you can, but again, don't prune them in the winter for two reasons. One, if you prune in the winter, you create that excessive growth I'm talking about. But also, there's a disease that plums get, which is a thing called silver leaf, and it tends to get in the tree in wounds in the winter. So if you prune in the winter, you're likely to get silver leaf as a disease.
So summer pruning again.
Yeah, summer pruning.
I've just got an infestation. I've got two little cherry trees, or one's a bit more than little because I need the ladder to pick the fruit. I noticed yesterday I've got great clusters of black fly on
them.
I have sprayed them with sort of, you know, dilute washing up liquid. But, any other tips as to how to get rid of them? The birds won't eat them.
If it's a tree that's small enough to get to easily, then I would just get some secateurs and just nip those off. And what you've done there is a bit of summer pruning. Now, it's early for that, but the tree won't mind. What you'll find is that they are a problem just at this stage for several reasons. Is that the black fly, this is when they feed on the shoots of trees like that, but secondly is the tree will start to defend itself soon, and so there's lots of evidence that it'll become unpalatable for the aphid. It changes chemically inside the tree so that they stop feeding on it. But actually, to get rid of it now, just some sharp secateurs or your sort of organic wash to go on them, but that will stop it from happening.
And the sooner the tree produces that its natural chemical defence against them, the better.
Yeah. And there's also evidence that some trees then communicate with each other, so that that actually you then get the whole glade, if you like, or the forest, knowing that there's a problem around.
So I just want my two cherry trees to to talk to each other.
But maybe they've fallen out. You could never tell, can you?
So there you are, some crucial pruning tips from Mike Burks, Managing Director of the Gardens Group. And I can see I've been doing my pruning all wrong. You may remember from one of the Countryside Matters programmes just over a year ago about the issues concerning the use of spot-on pet flea and tick treatment, and how two of the chemicals in commonly used non-prescription brands were killing the chicks and found in the eggs of some of our more common garden songbirds. This year, and just recently, the charity Songbird Survival have been publicising the results of further studies into these chemicals, which they and other conservation bodies are campaigning to get banned from non-prescription sale. I asked Dr. Emma Phipps of Songbird Survival to tell me more.
So the two main chemicals that are found in a large number of these kind of spot-on flea and tick treatments are fipronil and imidacloprid. So both of those chemicals are banned for agricultural use in the EU and the UK. So fipronil was banned back in 2013 and imidacloprid was banned in 2018. So imidacloprid is part of the family of chemicals called neonicotinoids, which have gained quite a lot of kind of negative press in recent years. I mean, they're obviously strong, very strong toxic insecticides, very bad for insects like bees. So that is one of the reasons they're not allowed for agricultural use. But, you know, despite that, they are very much widely used for our companion animals, so pet cats and dogs. Mainly in these spot-on flea treatments or in the kind of collars that you can buy for dogs. So they're those common active ingredients in those.
So those are the two culprits, spot-on and the collars?
Yes, exactly, yeah. I mean, there's chemicals used, obviously, the insecticides are used in all of the treatments, but with the collars and the spot-on, they're the biggest culprits of passing the chemicals into the environment. It's obviously they can come directly from your dog or cat's kind of neck or from the collars if your dog's swimming. So it's kind of quite easy for them to access the environment.
How was the alarm first raised on these, Emma?
Well, I think, actually, having spoken to a number of vets now, I think the alarm was raised on these chemicals being in the environment quite a number of years ago. There's a lot of research that has come out in the years since of both of these chemicals, fipronil and imidacloprid, being found in rivers around the UK. One study of 20 rivers in England found that 99% contained fipronil and 66% contained imidacloprid. So the presence is really widespread, and this is something that vets are very much aware of. And as I said, having spoken to a number of them with Songbird Survival, you know, they're very kind of upset about the issue, and they want their clients to be aware of this. And as I said, the evidence is really growing. There's a substantial amount of evidence there now that these chemicals really are widespread and that they are reaching the wildlife in our ecosystems as well.
Well, Emma, was there presence in the water found accidentally initially?
I believe that, yeah, it was done through kind of scientific research projects. At the moment, the government does not monitor for these chemicals in our rivers. So despite the fact that research shows that quite often they're being found at rates far exceeding the environmental toxicity thresholds, which suggests that they really are harming our aquatic invertebrates. And you know, these invertebrates are at the bottom of so many food chains, including, you know, going straight into our songbirds, into fish, into other wildlife. So yeah, I think at the moment, because there is no environmental monitoring, it really was down to scientists who were worried about this issue, them discovering this.
Now, it was about a year ago, I think, wasn't it, when your charity sounded first, I think, sounded the alarm about the effects, the negative effects on our garden songbirds. And that was from research done with Sussex University, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, Songbird Survival funded two different research projects actually. So, one was a couple of years ago, it was a more general study looking at the effects of pesticides on songbirds, so including those pesticides that are in your garden, for example. And then a second research project was looking more specifically at these veterinary drugs, so the fipronil and imidacloprid, and their effects on the birds. So, yeah, January last year, we published the first scientific paper from that work from Sussex, and that found that all of the nests studied contained fipronil. So, 100% of the nests were containing fipronil, which was a really quite shocking result. And 89% contained imidacloprid, and that's from 100 nests that contained fur. So, around three quarters of bird species will actually use fur or kind of animal hair in building their nests. They use it in the lining for cushioning for their chicks. So, you know, this really indicates that despite just looking at blue tits and grey tits in this study, this is a kind of could be a widespread problem for other species as well. And that really led on to the more recent research that has come out from those two projects. So one paper revealed very high levels of fipronil and imidacloprid in feathers of common garden bird species. So the paper looked at blackbirds, blue tits, goldfinches, chaffinches, and dunnocks, and they were from seven sites around the UK. And it found an average of four pesticides per sample, which is quite shocking that these are just on our favourite garden bird species. And then a second paper, which was building on the work looking at the nests, looked further into that. So we looked at the eggs and the chicks found in those nests that were donated by BTO volunteers. And quite shockingly, it found an average of two insecticides in the unhatched eggs and three insecticides on average in dead chicks. And the most frequently found were again those fipronil and imidacloprid, and then any metabolites that might come from those. So they really are appearing everywhere. I think originally, obviously, scientists were concerned, of course, that they were everywhere in our waterways, but this research is really showing that first evidence of these pesticides being present in kind of avian tissues as well.
And that can be put down directly, can it, to disposing of pet hair, can it?
Yes, I think, well, so pet hair and pet fur being disposed outside is possibly a large contributor. So, I mean, I myself used to put my dog's fur outside. I thought, and I'm sure a lot of people do that.
I did
It
too.
seems like a nice, comfy material, which if you don't treat your pet, that is absolutely fine. But if you are treating your pet cat or dog with any of these treatments, it's best to just dispose of the fur into the bin. But actually, a lot of research has also found that these pesticides are getting into the environment directly down the drain. So, for example, if you're washing your dog, or if you're washing their bedding, or for example, just as simple as washing your hands after applying these treatments. In fact, the studies kind of found that the wash off from your hands can be emitting into the environment these pollutants for up to 28 days after you've actually treated your pet. So I think a lot of pet owners are unwittingly really contributing to this pollution. People are unaware that these chemicals can last on their hands for up to a month. They're unaware that they are letting their dog swim, and the chemicals are kind of washing off into the environment. So what, you know, Songbird Survival really want to do is make pet owners aware of these potential kind of emissions coming from their pet or from their own hands.
Tell me that I know that it's two particular products that you're keen to see banned from across the counter sales, Frontline and Advocate. How did they manage to escape the environmental impact assessment by our regulatory bodies? I mean, how could that have happened?
So it was historically deemed that these products didn't have kind of any negative environmental effects. So unlike products that are used on livestock, they will go through an environmental risk assessment, the kind of phase two environmental risk assessment, which will look into if these products do leach into the environment, and if they do, if there are any kind of negative consequences. However, back when these products were first being made, it was deemed that as they were just being used on small companion animals, that they really wouldn't have any effect. And we know now that that's obviously completely incorrect. And what Songbird Survival are trying to do is to lobby the government to really make an urgent change on this and make sure that veterinary medications do need to go through this second environmental risk assessment to really get that evidence of how they're affecting the environment, how they might be affecting ecosystems, etc. And that is what's quite difficult with this problem, is that whilst there are alternatives to these spot-on flea treatments, so we've got oral tablets. I've actually recently moved my own dog onto these tablets after speaking to my vet. So we've got those and also some injectables. Whilst those are alternatives, we still at this point don't know if they're necessarily much better in terms of their environmental impact. I mean, for me, I make sure that I pick up my dog's feces, as with the tablet versions of these products, they kind of get excreted that way. So it's potentially easier to reduce the environmental impact compared to kind of spot-ons on the fur. But really, this needs to be the government making the changes to make sure that these products can't be kind of leaching into the environment at all.
It's a very difficult one, isn't it? Because you've just said that even with the tablet form and presumably the injectable form too, that these chemicals could still end up in the environment despite our best intentions and our best endeavours.
Yeah, that's it. That's what's so difficult. We can't, you know, vets at the moment can't say that one product is definitely better than the other. We can infer from the fact that obviously tablets you don't put directly on the fur that, you know, less product will be leaching into the environment. The best thing people can do, I think pet owners can do, is really speak to their vet about alternatives. For a lot of pets, dependent on their lifestyle or kind of, you know, indoor or outdoor cat, for example, they may not be need to have monthly annual treatment. And, you know, there are 22 million cats and dogs collectively in the UK, many of which are receiving monthly spot-on treatments when actually they may not need those year-round. In winter and early spring, tick and fleas are kind of lower risk, so you may not need to be treating at that time. What we really want to see is just reduced overall use, and that's what your vet can kind of help you with. You can speak to them about a risk-based approach, which looks at your specific pet, tailors their treatment to what your pet does, where they are. An indoor cat, for example, that doesn't spend any time outside has a much lower risk of parasites, for example. So your vet may advise you that they might not need to be treated as often as, say, a dog that is running around outside all year round. What we would also say is as I mentioned earlier, just don't put that fur outside. And also just making sure you check leaflet guidance as well. The only thing with this is that we have found that a lot of these product leaflets and instructions don't actually mention the kind of environmental risk of these products. So it's worth being aware, so that if you are someone who treats your dog with a spot-on treatment, just prevent them from swimming in outdoor water sources for the kind of treatment phase. So that's for if you're treating every month, that would be year-round. But it's just making sure you're aware that those residues can persist for the full month of that treatment.
A tricky one that, Emma, because of course, as you know, most of us don't read all the sort of lengthy essays that are provided with any medication that we get now. And you were mentioning, you know, you don't need to treat in the winter months. But speaking to a vet friend, I know that the fleas and ticks are dormant or inactive during the winter and spring, and their populations may die down. But this is where, of course, climate change rears its ugly head, and the flea and tick season is extending, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the many threats that our songbirds themselves face is this changing climate. So I think it's an issue that we have to look at with the kind of changing times, keep up to date with the latest evidence, and as I said, just really speaking to a vet is the best thing that you can do. I mean, there are animals in, you know, certain areas that probably are higher risk and do need to be treated year round. But even if they continue to be treated, but other animals have less treatment, then that can make so much difference to the amount of this product that is leaching into the environment and kind of reaching our songbirds and also other wildlife as well in the food chain. So any reduction in use will always be helpful. Same with kind of pesticide use in gardens. I mean, we've talked about some of the research that came up with Sussex looking at chemicals in the birds' feathers. This can also kind of come from the pesticides we use in our gardens. So a natural approach to our gardens will also always help, you know, reducing the use of pesticide, choosing kind of natural pesticides instead. So for example, I had quite a large aphid infestation in my garden recently, and you can actually buy ladybirds and ladybird aphids online. So I kind of chose to do that instead, and they've sorted the issue out. So I think it's just making informed decisions, especially as you say, as the climate is changing, speaking to the professionals and trying to make a responsible choice.
Well, you say that, and finally, Emma, of course, I know there's a whole segment of pet owners who don't go anywhere near the vet because of either, usually for reasons of expense, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, this is something we have talked to vets themselves a lot about, and also we've spoken with groups like the RSPCA, as this is obviously a huge concern. So we need to think about pet and animal welfare as well as obviously our wildlife welfare. So I think, you know, for people that aren't going to the vet already, they can continue to keep an eye on their vets. And I think expense, as you mentioned, could be an issue in this. But what we want to see is really, as I said, responsible usage and actually probably reduced usage of these products, which could actually reduce price overall for pet owners that aren't actually having to spend, you know, on the subscription basis for the use of their medications. So I think for anyone concerned about that, it may be that actually they're reducing the costs, as they may not need to be treating as much as they originally thought they needed to be.
But you've still got to urge those people who currently don't go to the vet to do so.
Yes, I think for people that don't go to the vet, it may be that they haven't experienced issues with parasites, so they may continue just not treating their animal. If they are treating their animal without veterinary advice, we would really encourage you to visit your vet and see what their professional advice is. I think a lot of these chemicals, you know, they're being sold in the supermarket, on subscription websites, without any veterinary advice. And I think for many people, they may find that their pet doesn't need as much as they're giving them. They may be exposing their household to these chemicals without needing to be. So it's just always worth speaking to the professional, seeing what they think for a tailored approach for your pet, and seeing actually if you can reduce overall use anyway and maybe reduce costs as well.
Dr. Emma Phipps, who's the Scientific Research and Impact Manager for the charity Songbird Survival. And indeed, there are certainly moves within the veterinary world to tackle the problem. Vet Kirk Hutton of Dorset's Friars Moor Vets gave me a little more detail about the treatments Emma was talking about.
Fipronil and imidacloprid are commonly used insecticides for preventing flea and tick infestations, lice as well, on cats and dogs. And the odd rabbit, the odd hamster. If there's a cat in the house, sometimes people treat the hamster as well. And they are generally used as a spot-on presentation. So they go on the coat, they go on the skin, and spread over the surface of the skin.
And that's what's causing the problem then?
That is why they are a problem. All of the insecticides, all the parasiticides that we use, will affect the nervous system of the invertebrates, basically, of all the little fleas and ticks. I mean, you don't want your dog to have fleas or your cat to have fleas or ticks or lice. It can cause significant suffering to your animal if it's scratching itself to pieces. There's also tick-borne diseases to think about. So, you know, I will defend the use of some sort of parasiticide, but I no longer prescribe anything unless my arm is twisted right up my back. Anything with fipronil, I haven't for some time, and now imidacloprid, because The way they work is they overexcite the nervous system of the fleas and the ticks. So it becomes lethal from that respect because they just are, well, whatever.
They have something effectively, yeah, something like, yeah, a,
yeah,
seizure.
Yeah. I'm thinking, yes. The problem with them is because they go on the skin, they spread over the surface of the body, of the body, and they are on every single hair on that cat or dog.
So even just a couple of drops on the back of the neck of the dog or the cat?
Yeah, because they are designed to spread so that if a flea bites a dog on its bottom, it will still be killed, even though you haven't put anything on that dog's bottom. It goes on the back of the neck so that the dog or cat can't lick it off. And then it spreads over the surface of the skin, or just the layers just underneath. But the problem is you then groom your cat. I mean, I've done it myself. Groom the cat, thinking that's lovely, nice fluffy stuff. And a bird might like that for nesting material. I've made sure there's no long bits, but I have put it out on the grass. Or I'll groom the dog outside and there's fluff everywhere, and I know the birds come and pick it up for their nest.
I'm sure all pet owners have done that. I mean, I've done that in the past myself too, thinking this would make nice nesting material or for nice warm lining material. But in fact, what it's doing is anything but nice.
Yes, so it's been found, cat and dog hair has been found on the inside of birds' nests in which there are unhatched eggs and also dead fledglings. One of the problem per se, but one of the things is you are getting uninformed use of it, of products with imidacloprid in and fipronil, because they can be bought over the counter. My issue with fipronil is actually there's massive resistance for fleas in this country to fipronil.
So they've got used to it, you mean?
Well, yes, the fleas have become there. A significant proportion of the fleas in certain areas, particularly in the south of England, are now resistant to it. So they've become accustomed to it and they've adapted, so it doesn't kill them. You get a quick knockdown effect, but sometimes the fleas will wake up again. So it doesn't actually kill them half the time. So what happens is people think, oh, well, that didn't work, so I'll put some more on. So the dog gets two doses, which is not going to hurt the dog, but then it's still not killing the fleas. And at that point, they turn up in my surgery and say, I've used all these things and nothing's working. And then I will give them something that's effective. But yes, it's been banned for agricultural use. There is now a move to make things like imidacloprid and fipronil a veterinary prescription product only, which will really control its use. And I think that would be a good thing, because it will just stop the blanket use of it on dogs and cats everywhere. More and more the veterinary profession are moving away from blanket treating a dog or a cat all year. Some individuals need it. We found a tick on my husband's spaniel in February this year.
When no ticks should be around.
So you've got global warming to consider. Now, we live in quite a cold house, so I was not expecting that. And I had not been treating the dogs over the winter because our house is so jolly cold. So normally we don't get a problem over the winter. I start on the 1st of April. But now we're going to have to consider starting earlier, or possibly treating that particular dog who goes down to the woods every single week, rain or shine, snow or hail. We may have to consider treating her all year round. And then you get people who keep their houses very warm. They perhaps have multiple animals, and some of the cats that hunt, some of them, yes, they do need treating all year round, but not everybody. So we are moving now in the veterinary profession to much more of a tailored approach.
To each individual animal,
To our use of insecticides on dogs and cats. The other one that is quite bad, there are collars you can get which contain imidacloprid and also a permethrin type of things called. The collars, particular collar I'm thinking of, which people will use because it's very convenient, and again, it's a surface spread. That also contains imidacloprid and also a thing that is related to permethrins, which again are banned, I believe. And they're quite toxic to cats as well, that one. A lot of dogs that have those collars on go swimming. So it's not just the bird's nest, they're also depositing it in the river as well. So
that's a problem that's been known about
for a couple of years,
isn't it?
Yes, along with the contraceptives and that are all in our waterways.
And everything else, all the chemicals that we humans put in there.
Yes, all the microplastics. But the songbird issue is a very real one, and it goes with overuse and use of the wrong medications. So I would favour something that goes internally. So you can get tablets that either last for 1 month or 3 months cover that contain things called ferroalerners. And ferroalerners do cause excitability, hyper-excitability in the insects. It's more, the creature has to bite to die. So you actually, it is a more targeted approach anyway. Plus, it does not get on the hair. It is not excreted into the skin of the dog and all the hair. So you could brush a dog that's had a tableted product, and that coat, those coat brushings, won't be any risk to the nesting birds. So I would favour that. And there is, for the one that lasts 3 months, there's now an injectable form, which is the insecticide is embedded in slow-release crystals that go under the skin, and they release very slowly over the next 12 to 13 months. And the benefit of that one, apart from being a lot less hassle to the owner having to give dog tablets, the other benefit is that it's about a third to a half of the amount of insecticide that you would use if you were giving it in a tableted form. So we're reducing. So we are pushing this one quite hard because
reducing the amount of insecticide
per se.
Which has got to be a good thing, hasn't
it? It's got to be a good thing. I'm not so worried about wormers. Wormers, we generally use a thing called milprazone, that type of wormer, and that actually breaks down very quickly in the dog or cat's body, so it's barely excreted.
But if we come back to the across-the-counter remedies, which an awful lot of people would just go into their local chemist and buy, that then means that people who might not necessarily have need to go to the vet and the expense of going to the vet, taking their dog or their cat to the vet, they've then got to do that then, haven't they? So
if it doesn't work, yes, so they've wasted the money, really. And I have seen dogs and cats that have literally, they've made themselves raw with scratching because of the fleas. It isn't a nice thing to have. So you do need to treat your dog or your cat, particularly in the warmer months, or if you keep your house very warm over the winter with central heating, and particularly humidity they like. And we get different years. What the flea really likes is almost tropical conditions. It likes a nice, warm, humid summer. That's what a flea really likes.
We don't mind those either, do we?
No, I'm quite partial to myself, but not to the fleas.
But if we come back to the fact that you know people presumably buy these products across the counter, believing that they're going to work, but also saving themselves the cost of going and having a visit to the vet.
Yes.
So that is a factor, isn't it, really?
It is a factor, but our hands are tied in that we are not allowed to prescribe certain products, like the ferroalerners, unless we have seen the dog or the cat and checked a history, checked its weight accurately, and checked that it is in a healthy state and fit to have it. So, you know, we're not allowed to just hand them out. We're allowed to authorise it for 12 months. But beyond that, no, we're not allowed to. So we're not profiteering in that respect. It's just we are legally not allowed to prescribe it. It has to be authorised, and it has to be authorised in writing or rather on the computer. And when we have our annual inspections or our three-yearly inspections, you know, that is one of the things that is looked at random on our computer, to see what we've dispensed and whether it was authorised by a vet.
So what would you, as a vet and representative of the vets as a whole, what would you like to see happen? Would you like to see these across-the-counter remedies banned?
Yes. Well, I would like to see their use severely restricted. And the only way you're going to do that is to put them in the hands, the dispensing of them in the hands of veterinary health professionals, like me, who will take quite a lot of time sometimes in a vaccine or other consultation explaining to people why I don't want them to give them what they always used to have.
And then with a bit of luck, if that all happened, then that would be good news for not just aquatic invertebrates, the insects that live in our rivers and our streams, but also for the songbirds that that live in our gardens.
A lot of, yeah, it certainly would. And we're learning all the time, aren't we? Like, we now realise that we're probably spreading gapeworm by feeding birds through the summer. But yes, so certain parasites. So things we think we're doing the right thing, sometimes we're not, because we don't know the whole story. That's the problem.
Vet Kirk Hutton of Dorset Veterinary Group, Friars Moor. It does very much sound from what Kirk was saying that the injectable treatment is so far the best answer if it means the amount of chemical injected can actually be reduced. So I'm going to add a special plea. Until a few years ago, I used the spot-on treatment on my dog, and like many, I'd put out his fur combings in the spring, thinking how good it would be for songbirds for their nests. I had no idea of the possible damage I was doing, so it came as a nasty surprise when Songbird Survival last year publicised the results of the Sussex University study they'd funded, showing how lethal that treatment was. I imagine plenty of us still don't realise what we're unwittingly doing to insects generally, and also to the birds we love. So please spread the word to any dog or cat owner you know to encourage them to use the injectable treatment, which I'll be doing for my new dog. They may already have gone down that route, of course, in which case, great. We're going to end today's Countryside Matters by hearing from several people who were at the World Heritage Day and Jurassic Coast 25 event held in Dorchester in April at the Dorset Museum and Art Gallery. And let's not forget that the Jurassic Coast is still England's only natural World Heritage site. Andy Wirth was there and spoke to a number of those exhibiting.
Well, here I am in Dorset Museum, and a familiar face here, a guy called Sam Scriven. What do you do and why are you here?
So I'm a geologist by background, and my job is Principal Officer for World Heritage at Dorset Council. So I help to facilitate and coordinate the management of the Jurassic Coast World Heritage Site.
So what do you want to achieve today?
Well, I'm just here to support the museum mainly in helping to celebrate 25 years of World Heritage Site status for the Dorset and East Devon coast. So I'm doing a talk, I'm doing some fossil identification, although I haven't had very many punters yet. And then later on this afternoon, I'm doing a tour of the gallery here.
Marvellous. And what will they see?
Well, all kinds of amazing fossils that come from the Jurassic Coast that are on display here at the museum, part of their collection. Some that have been in the collection for 150 years, some that are newer, some are enormous, like the pliosaur skull, which is a 2-metre-long thing, and the others are tiny, like an insect's wing. So there's all kinds of things.
What's the most exciting thing in your field that's happened this year? Not necessarily to you, but globally.
Oh my goodness me, what a question. Okay, well, I'm going to pick something that sounds really mundane, but it is really important for me. Actually, it is in my field. So Natural England have a new strategy that they published last year, and in it is a definition of what nature is. And you'd have thought that we would have already had one of those, wouldn't we? But actually, we have never had something that's formally articulated what the definition of nature is. And crucially for me as a geologist, right in there is geology. Geology is part of nature, because often people think of nature as being wildlife and the living things, and they forget about all the amazing bits of nature that aren't alive but that are contributing so much to our surroundings all the time.
I'm Sally King, and I'm part of the Dorset National Landscape Team. I'm here because it's World Heritage Day, which is very exciting, and the Jurassic Coast has been a World Heritage Site for 25 years. And I was actually involved from the very beginning when it was first inscribed on the UNESCO World Heritage List. So I've been involved for a long time. And yeah, I love the Jurassic Coast. I think it's the most amazing World Heritage Site. It's the only natural World Heritage Site in England. And we're just very lucky to live near it. And we're here to celebrate 25 years of the Jurassic Coast today.
So the main aim of the Dorset National Landscape is what?
Our main aim is to enhance and conserve the protected landscape, which is the Dorset National Landscape. National landscapes used to be called areas of outstanding natural beauty, but have been rebranded national landscapes across the country. We're part of a family of national landscapes that does a huge amount of work to enhance, conserve. We work with farmers, we work with access, improving accessibility, We work with schools and we do things like this, helping to promote the natural environment to the general public.
What's your favourite area?
Oh, that's a hard question. I think I would have to pick somewhere on the Jurassic Coast, and I'll go for Ringstead Bay.
So I'm Macarena Stiles, a manager at the West Bay Discovery Centre. We provide different information for our visitors who are around West Bay and Bridport area. And we also hold exhibitions. We have a permanent exhibition talking about geology, about history of West Bay, the heritage of West Bay. And also we have pop-up exhibitions twice a year about different topics, different themes. So at the moment, our current exhibitions is about changing landscapes, and it's all about cliff falls, geology, the fossils that are unveiling after the cliff falls. So, and also the protection of the environment, some climate change. So we are talking about all those topics that are really relevant in this moment. And also we offer family activities, so children and their family can come to us and have a wonderful time doing activities. We have a cliff fall making, we have like an activity bench, we have the coloring, we do crafts during the holiday season. So yeah, it's lot to do, lot to see for everyone, any age, and everyone is welcome.
How do you find the Discovery Centre?
So the Discovery Centre is in West Bay, just off the Bridport Town Centre. So if you follow the directions to A35 and to Bridport, and then at the runabout called Crown Runabout, so you turn left, and then you're going to find West Bay Road. Follow the West Bay Road until the end, and then turn right into the harbour, and you're going to find us next to the car park on the left-hand side.
Marvellous. And is it free?
Yes, it's free. A free entry for everyone, and donations are very welcome. Bridport and West Bay is very attractive for visitors and tourists, and you can visit every week the market, which is on Wednesdays and Saturdays, and also you can visit from Bridport to West Bay taking the shuttle bus, which is only £1 from Bridport to West Bay, and then you can get back into Bridport again, so you can have a wonderful day.
My name's Ginny Slade, and I'm a volunteer and community engagement manager for English Heritage, and I look after sites in Dorset. Our English Heritage sites are free to enter once, the ones that you don't have to pay to go onto, and also I support our pay-to-enter sites like Portland Castle. So I'm here today really to showcase how we conserve our sites. And this is, there's lots of activities here for children and for adults alike. And each activity really is sort of an education offer to show you how we might, for example, the different colours and techniques you'd use to use mortar for our sites, how we protect different, when we have items that have got lots of colour on them, how do we protect them from light pollution, how do we make sure that those colours stay vivid. We've also got our sandpit, which is very popular, again, with everybody, and how we might do an archaeological dig and what we might find, how we would look after those objects as well. So it looks very much like it's attractive to children, and that's what we want, but we want adults as well to enjoy.
Well, we're all children at heart, aren't we? Especially when there's sand.
Absolutely. So this is what we call our Conservation in Action roadshow, where we take these items to various community events like this wonderful one today, and to our sites, and we allow people just to get hands-on and understand how we care for our sites.
Well, just for the listeners' benefit, do you know where you're going next?
Where am I going next? Well, after today, I'm going to be going on to Maiden Castle, because I'm one of the team who are fortunate to be the guardians of that site, and it is our role to make sure that that site is welcome to everybody. It's a really good experience, it's safe to navigate, so that's one of English Heritage's job, is to actually manage the sites that we look after on behalf of the nation. So I'm off to Maiden Castle next.
Well, for those that don't know, what's the significance of Maiden Castle?
Well, it is the largest Iron Age hill fort in the UK, it's also a very important ecology site as well, very popular with walkers, but its heritage is something we really want to celebrate, and we're working with the Dorset Museum and Art Gallery. We've been training up tour guides with the Dorset Museum, and they're now offering tours of the site itself just to showcase its history from an Iron Age hill fort to when the Romans then occupied. There's a Roman temple on the top of it that a lot of people don't know about. But apart from that, it's got the most magnificent views, and it's a really great place to go and walk from a well-being perspective. It's really, really engaging. And also from ecology, we've got a King's Meadow on the site as well. So it's, you know, for what looks like a big hill, actually it's a very important big hill.
And there's something else about Maiden Castle you were going to say.
Absolutely. So the site is really important to the community. We want the community to really engage with it and act as our ears and eyes for the site, and also to help us maintain it. So what I'm currently doing, or English Heritage are doing, we are recruiting a team of what we call Heritage Ranger volunteers. That role covers three main areas. That is A, to act as our eyes and ears and report back to us as a team, just to say how the footpaths are doing, are there any issues on there, and welcome visitors, meet and greet, give a little bit of history if they want to. And also the main activity is to help us with maintenance. We understand that it gets a lot of visitors, that comes with a lot of wear and tear on our chalk footpaths, so we need to maintain them, and we're going to ask the community and our Heritage Ranger volunteers to help us do that. So we've got a big program coming up, so anybody who's interested in volunteering at the site, wants to make new friends, wants to do a bit of health and well-being with us, you are very welcome. All you need to do is apply on the English Heritage volunteer website page.
And those were just some of the people Andy Worth of Keep 106 spoke to at the World Heritage Day at the Dorset Museum in April. And that brings us to the end of Countryside Matters for today. Thanks for listening, and thanks to the Gardens Group for its support of the programme. This is Jenny Devitt saying bye-bye until next time.